Perhaps you've noticed that over the last couple of months, I have been attempting to go through portions of the Old Testament, particularly portions referring to the kings, talking about Elijah and a few other people. We're trying to go through some of those things and pick out of those things that are worthy of our discussion. Today, I want us to think about one particular individual. It's not someone that you know very well. In fact, the title that I have given this is simply a name you can't pronounce, a man you can't forget. The name is Jehoshaphat. Most of us have a little trouble pronouncing that name. He is one of the kings of Judah. Among other things, Jehoshaphat is overshadowed by the fact that he lived during Elijah's time. We know Elijah the prophet. In fact, if we look into the New Testament, we see that Elijah, along with Moses, is considered one of the two greatest of the prophets of the Old Testament. Jehoshaphat's reign is overshadowed by the fact that he lived during that time period. However, we might want to think about the fact that he is notable because there was no need for an Elijah in his administration. During his time, Judah is still faithful to the Lord, in large measure due to the work of Jehoshaphat, the king. We're told in 1 Kings chapter 22 that he ascends the throne of Judah in the fourth year of Ahab's reign. We know Ahab because we've talked about him a few times already. Ahab is the one married to this woman by the name of Jezebel, who has become a kind of byword for evil. Ahab's reign was marked by 3 years of famine that Elijah started and finished. His reign is marked by Elijah's work on Mount Carmel, this great event where he challenges the prophets of Baal. And among other things, we know a lot about the man named Ahab. Jehoshaphat's kind of the other guy. Ahab's the king of Israel in the north. Jehoshaphat is the king of Judah in the south. Jehoshaphat makes peace with Ahab and goes into battle with him against Syria. We read about that whole event in 1 Kings chapter 22. One of the notable things that he does in this particular episode is that he is the one who asks for advice from, quote, a prophet of the Lord. You may remember that before they went into battle, they try to get advice from the prophets. And 400 prophets, and it's notable the way it's written in there, they're just called 400 prophets. And they all say that, yeah, going into battle, you're going to win. But Jehoshaphat, being a man of God, a man of the Lord, he says, is there not a prophet of the Lord of whom we can inquire? And the story goes on to say that, yeah, there's one guy there. Ahab says, but I don't like him. He never says anything good about me. And in fact, he comes on and he doesn't say anything good about the situation. But he is the one who asks for a prophet of the Lord. Very specific. His reign, in some ways, is marred by alliances he makes with the evil kings of Israel, namely Ahab and his son Ahaziah, and a different prophet of the Lord confronts him on both accounts. But as most of the kings of Judah are, he is, for the most part, faithful to God. And it says he walks in the ways of his father David. And you can see in 2 Chronicles chapter 17, verses 3 and 6, that particular comment is made. He sets his heart wholeheartedly to follow the Lord. And that probably is the reason why he's able to say to Ahab, well, we need to consult the Lord on this, not just all these other prophets. His reign is mostly good. He models the kind of leadership that teaches and inspires faithfulness. And I suppose if nothing else today, we should get two things out of this. Number one, we should learn about what it means to be a leader of God's people. And number two, for all of us, we can find someone who's worthy of imitation. Not only in some of the things that he does, but in his faith. In the fact that he does try to be faithful to the Lord. And as a result of what he did, I would suggest to you, we have the kingdom today. It was his faithfulness in Judah and faithfulness to all of the law that helped promote and bring about the kingdom that was established under the reign of Jesus Christ. Three things he does, I think, are significant for our discussion today. Number one, he demonstrates a tremendous amount of courage. Now, I've always found that particular characteristic or virtue an interesting one. Generally, when we think of courage, we think of courage going into battle, courage to confront, courage to, you know, do all kinds of things that are seem heroic. But in Joshua chapter 1 and verse 7, Joshua is told to have courage to do everything written in the law. When Joshua is on the verge of going into battle and of taking his nation into a country and conquer that nation, the one aspect of courage he is told to have is the courage to institute everything in the law. It takes courage to stick to God's word, doesn't it? With war looming before Joshua, God's exhortation is to obey the law. To make sure the community follows you in obeying God's commands. Joshua perhaps knew the courage he was going to have going into battle. In fact, my suspicion is, in a way, they kind of didn't need that much because they knew God was going to fight for them. But God would only fight for them if they had the courage, first of all, to do His will. And that courage sometimes is required of us, not only to face the world, but sometimes to face the war that wages within us when we want to say, no, I don't want to obey the law. I don't want to do what God says. All those desires that keep us from obeying, we talked a little bit this morning about the weariness of our souls, the acedia that sometimes overcome us. It's going to take courage to confront that, along with all the other things that wage war in our hearts. Jehoshaphat, in a way, is a person who bucks the trend. In 2 Chronicles chapter 17 and verse 4 is probably where we see it expressed most fully. Look, start at verse 3. 2 Chronicles 17, verses 3 and 4. The Lord was with Jehoshaphat because he walked in the earlier ways of his father David. He did not seek the Baals, but sought the God of his father and walked in his commandments and not according to the practices of Israel. He demonstrates the kind of courage that Joshua in Joshua chapter 1 was told to have. And it's very interesting here because he in some ways aligns himself with Ahab, the king in the north. And it's probably going to be somewhat tempting to him, as well it is for all of the people of Israel, because more often than not, they always seem tempted to worship these Canaanite deities, namely Baal, and later on he'll mention this one, Ashtoreth. They're gods of the Canaanites. And it's tempting for them to always worship them. There may be some particular reasons why these gods were so tempting, but the fact is, they kept seeing these, and well, why are we worshiping the Lord when we can worship these gods? And there were reasons for that, but the fact is, Jehoshaphat says, no, we are not going to worship the Baals. And it says in verse 6 that he removed the Asherim and the high places. They were only to worship one place that was in the temple at Jerusalem, and that was to worship God, the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth, the one who had brought them out of Egypt and made them a nation. Only he was to be worshipped. What courage does it take to stem the tide of immorality, even today? And if worshiping those gods was nothing, it was a worship of immorality in many ways. How about the courage we need to simply resist the flow of secularism, of just simply ignoring God? Or how much courage does it take to say no to materialism, to say no to the things that maybe we don't really need, but we just really want them because they're new, or because they're bigger, or because they're faster, or because they give us more status? How much courage does it take to say no to those things? The first step, I believe, in falling away is losing the courage to follow God in all things. Jehoshaphat is courageous. The next characteristic that I think is important when we consider Jehoshaphat's leadership is that simply, he does lead. In 2 Chronicles chapter 17, verses 7 through 9, and in 2 Chronicles chapter 19, verses 4 through 11, we see absolutely one of the most brilliant strokes of leadership that I think we can find in the Old Testament. Or I should say one of them. We think of David and all the great leadership that he provided. Jehoshaphat does something here that it really is quite brilliant. And you kind of look at it and go, well, how come we didn't think of that? It's that kind of brilliance. You know, sometimes you overlook those things that, well, you know, everybody, you know, we just don't often see how important a certain particular thing is. But one of the things that Jehoshaphat does is he takes his leadership out to the people. He assigns certain individuals to go out to the people and to make sure he teaches them. He kind of gets their support in serving the Lord. And he gets these people to teach them the law. He goes out to them. He doesn't wait for them to come. He goes out and he builds a grassroots movement of serving the Lord. He makes sure everybody's on board with him. In this case, they are simply providing a framework for what their community is supposed to be about. Namely, following God through the law. And they are told to teach the law. And they're told not to subvert the law by briberies and so forth. They are going to teach a moral code that's going to govern their families, their businesses, and their court proceedings. The law of God provided for all of that. It provided for them and made sure they understood that being faithful to God would mean all of these other things. And you see, with a clear understanding of what God wanted, Judah was able to avoid the perversions and idolatry that aroused God's anger. They probably would not have been able to do it otherwise. He's providing for them the right framework. He's sort of defining the playing field for them. But he takes his people and he sends them out to them that they might know. Leaders go to the people. It says of his officials, they went about throughout all the cities of Judah and taught among the people. You see, good leaders rub shoulders with the people they lead. They interact with them. They talk to them. They engage them in any number of different ways. Maybe they eat with them and have fellowship with them. They don't wait for the people to come to them. They go, they teach, they inspire. That's what leaders do. That's how they develop people. Leaders, you see, have to invest their time in people, not just in projects, but in people. Jehoshaphat understands that if he's going to lead them, he's got to develop them. He's got to develop leadership in them on a grassroots level. So he goes to them. His representatives go to them, but he nonetheless is the one who's kind of going to them. He tells his officials, here's what I want you to do. Here's what you're to teach. Here's how you bring them around to be sort of on our side so that we build one community. And by sending out his officials, you see, the king invested the energy of his government in developing a grassroots following. You know, I look at it and go, how come we didn't think of that before? That's what leadership is all about. When a project, a job, or a crisis arises, a leader will first of all have to have spent his time in developing the attitudes and capabilities necessary to address it. You know, to go out and tell people that we got a war here, this nation is trying to get us, you know, you better be prepared, or they better be prepared to know why they should fight for you. And have a reason to fight. Basically, that's what he does. He gives them a reason to be faithful. If a leader has not invested his time in people first, he won't have the most important resource that he needs. Not only does he succeed in this by sending them out, but I want you to notice further on, I want you to read later on today, verses 14 through 19 of this chapter. 2 Chronicles chapter 19. I'm sorry, it's 2 Chronicles. Oh, I've got the wrong chapter here. Anyway, there's a place in here somewhere where he talks to them and we are told just how many fighting men he has. It's listed. I'm sorry, it's chapter 17. Yeah, thank you. Somebody said it already. He lists just how many fighting men he had. I suspect that had he not gone to the people and told them what they were all about, given their community and identity, brought them together, a kind of patriotism, if you will, but certainly faithfulness to God, he might not have been able to go through and count, I got this many fighting men and this many fighting men, and you know, would he have had those people? I suggest to you he would not have had those people. But he spends his time investing in them and developing them. And it's also, we're also told that he gets a blessing from God as a result of all of that. So he has already demonstrated two acts that are significant in his leadership. Number one, he has demonstrated courage. Number two, he leads by going out to where the people are. He leads by developing people. That's what leaders do. And number three, he reveals faith at very critical moments. In 2 Chronicles chapter 20 and verses 1 through 4, Judah is threatened. After this, the Moabites and Ammonites, and with them some of the Munites, even I can't pronounce it, came against Jehoshaphat for battle. Some men came and told Jehoshaphat, "A great multitude is coming against you from Edom, from beyond the sea, and behold, they are in Hazen Tamar," that is in Gedi. Then Jehoshaphat was afraid and set his face to seek the Lord and proclaimed a fast throughout all Judah. And Judah assembled to help seek help from the Lord. From all the cities of Judah they came to seek the Lord. Well, you're going to see several things here, not the least of which is he demonstrates his own faith by seeking the Lord. But when he sends people out and he proclaims this fast, he's already got people that they know what this is all about. Why? Because he's already spent time investing in developing them. And so what he has done here, he demonstrates his faithfulness by simply doing the first thing that all people of faith do, and that is they turn to the Lord. Jehoshaphat's faith is, first of all, strategic. He plans based on his faith in the Lord. That's his first strategy. That's the first thing he does. And whatever plans he's going to make, it's going to be because he has gone to God. He has had faith in God. And that's simply a matter of him just, all right, what am I going to do here? First thing I'm doing is going to go to God. Then I'm going to find out what God wants me to do and to enlist God's help. That's strategic. That's what people should always be doing. That's what his father David did. Always turn to the Lord in crisis. Now I suspect here that Jehoshaphat was able to do that because he had always been turning to the Lord even when there wasn't a crisis. But it was just a good strategy, just good planning. And he would make his plans based on his faith in God and what God revealed to him. And the story goes on that God reveals to him that he's going to be successful, not to worry about it, but you know, because you've turned to me. And I think because they've always been faithful in this fast, they entreated the Lord and got what they needed. But it's interesting also that Jehoshaphat's faith is also tactical. He has to make changes on the battlefield, and we see that specifically in one instance in 1 Kings chapter 22 when he's out on the battlefield. But let me preface that with saying, I believe it was Dwight Eisenhower, president during the 50s and five-star general during World War II, was fond of saying that battle plans are everything before the battle. But after the battle begins, plans are pretty worthless. And the reason is because you don't always know the enemy's reactions. You don't always know how he's going to respond on the battlefield. It is said that that George Patton was able to know how Rommel was going to respond in Africa because he'd read all of his books. But for the most part, we don't always know how our enemy is going to react. Faith may be our strategic plan in the beginning, and faith will be our tactical plan, but somehow it's got to look a little different on the battlefield. Things are going to happen that we don't expect. And what we have to do is we have to be able to adjust to those things. That's what coaches do at halftime in football. They make adjustments because they didn't know how the enemy was going to react. 1 Kings chapter 22, Jehoshaphat's in battle against the king of Syria. He's allied himself with Ahab, and when he gets out on the battlefield, the king of Syria tries to kill him because he's the only one with their royal robes on. And it says in 1 Kings 22 that he cries out to the Lord, and the Lord protected him. And he was able to escape. But he cries out to the Lord in that moment. He makes a tactical, faithful gesture by crying out to the Lord at the moment. And that's kind of what we sometimes have to do as well, don't we? Our strategy is always to be faithful. But sometimes, tactically, our faith may kind of take a different turn. But we have to adjust it. Trusting in God is both strategic and tactical, because things happen that we're not ready for. I had an interesting experience on Friday when I went in to swim. Walked into the area, there's a little lobby area right outside the locker rooms, and the sign said, there was a big sign out there, and it said, women are to use the men's locker room today, and men are to use the women's locker room today. So, I walked into the women's locker room, and I'm going, no, this can't be right. You know, I went out, I looked at the sign again. I said, it says men use the women's. I said, okay, there's the sign. It says so. But you know what? It's so unnatural. It's so unexpected that I'm going to be going into the women's locker room today. And generally they do that when the plumbers are coming in and the plumbers have to work in the women's locker room so that men are, they just put the men in there. But I'm in there getting ready to go into swim, and I'm going, this just doesn't feel right. I'm sorry, this can't be right. Some other guy walks in. He says, oh, I'm so glad to see you in here. I feel better now. I said, okay, if we're wrong, we're both going to get arrested. But you see, we weren't expecting that. It's so out of context for what we normally do. And I think sometimes our faith is like that too, isn't it? We encounter things that we're not ready for, because they don't seem to fit the pattern that we're used to seeing in our lives. And we have to be able to adjust in our faith. Good leaders have to do that. They have to be able to lead through change. They have to be able to lead us through times of change and adjust to what's happening. God Himself doesn't always behave in ways we think He should or will, or in ways that we have preconceived that God is supposed to act. And so our faith, in a way, has to kind of have this tactical side to it. Be ready sometimes for the unexpected. Courage. Investing time in others. Faith, both strategic and tactical. These are the things of leadership. These are the things the church needs. Even if you can't pronounce Jehoshaphat, don't forget him. Don't forget what he does. This individual that doesn't get a whole lot of press time in spiritual writings, he doesn't get any mention in the New Testament. And maybe it's because he didn't need to be mentioned. Maybe it's because he was just one of those faithful individuals who did the right things during his reign, and there was no need to kind of bring up the good news. It's kind of the thing we do sometimes. We look at all the bad news and forget the good things. Here was a good thing. Don't forget him. God needs people even today who will imitate his courage, his investing of his time in others, and his faith. Consider Jehoshaphat for your life this week.